I'd like now to welcome Fran Levine. She's the director of the New Mexico History Museum, which is opening this weekend, and Tom Leach, curator of the Palace Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I can't believe you've made time to come here on what must be the busiest week of your life, getting ready for the opening of this incredible museum.
Well, it was the great escape. It gave us the opportunity to sit still for just a minute. So thank you for having us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. So this is a museum. I took a tour of the museum in with all the busy bees finishing all the exhibits and things that are opening this coming Sunday. It really is an extension of, in a way, the Palace of the Governors. It's a way to really open up these many, many objects that the Palace of the Governors has had all these years but have been basically in storage.
Yes, that's really the purpose for the New Mexico History Museum project, was to take the pressure off the Palace of the Governors so the palace could be free to tell its own story as witness to history. And these collections that we never had exhibition space or the proper climate control conditions, that we could bring them out and show them to the public.
And it's so great to see some of these artifacts that I know have been in storage for as long as I've been at the museum, I think 8 years now. And I was in one of the galleries this morning as we were putting pieces in the cases, and I was just amazed. Every one of these pieces has a story to tell. It's really inspiring.
So telling the story of these pieces, of course, the palace is its own story and has really become kind of an artifact and a giant artwork all its own.
Yes, that was really part of the architectural plan, was to keep the reference back to the palace and the reverence for the palace. So from the time you walk into the History Museum, you're walking along the north wall of the Palace of the Governors, and that itself becomes an exhibition wall. When you cross over, when you enter the palace, you look across that gorgeous courtyard and see the crossroads and bridge that connects the two buildings. So the palace hasn't lost its place. In many ways, it's enhanced.
Yeah, you can really see it juxtaposed against this ultra-modern building. And its sweetness really comes out.
Right.
That's all I can say about it.
When you say exhibition wall, you mean there are actually foundation stones that are exposed, and the way the building is built is kind of shown to the public.
Yes, and we will be, we're getting ready to sometime this summer install an interpretive panel that will show you. When we restored that palace wall, it was done by Ed Crocker. And Ed Crocker is very famous for adobe preservation. He used 4 or 5 different colors of mud. And following the different colors of mud, you can follow the evolution of that portion of the palace from the 18th century to the present. It's quite a wonderful exhibit wall.
So then, following the history of New Mexico chronologically, starts, of course, with the Native American people of this region. A lot of those artifacts are in other museums.
Exactly. You know, at one point, the Museum of New Mexico was all in the Palace of the Governors, but over the years, it diversified to other museums, and the palace lost its collection of Native American artifacts. So those are some of the things that we had to borrow back for this exhibit.
So you're borrowing back from the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture.
And we borrowed from the American Museum of Natural History. We've borrowed from our sister museums, mm-hmm. the New Mexico Museum of Art, the Museum of Indian Art and Culture, the Museum of International Folk Art. We've borrowed from the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art. Those are all of our sister museums in Santa Fe. But then we've borrowed collections from universities, museums,
private
collectors mm-hmm. all over the state. We really want the exhibitions in the New Mexico History Museum to not just be Santa Fe-centric. We've really made it a point to tell the history of New Mexico in all regions and with multiple voices.
It is, when you talk about the history of New Mexico is a construct. I mean, talk about imposing a four-cornered shape, or a little more than that, but basically a big rectangle on the land. New Mexico is something that mean, it was once Mexico. All sorts of different people feed into this history.
Yeah, we address that in an area called Shifting Boundaries, and we have a video interactive and computer screen interactive, so you can see the boundaries changing and hear some of the stories and some of the issues that come up when you do change. I mean, put on a landscape something that's so foreign as these lines that suddenly mean something that they never meant before.
That was a very conscious, that was one of the most engaging parts of the exhibition to develop, is how do you tell the story of the emergence of New Mexico's political boundaries. And it was best done using this computer interactive so that you could see how the east boundary shifts, how the west boundary shifts, how the north boundary is defined, how that southern boundary between the United States and Mexico is drawn, and the both political and personal issues that came up for people in the definition of New Mexico's boundaries. So that's it's a very engaging area, but one of the more difficult that we had to create.
There were a lot of debates about what would go into this.
I mean, we've got some time. Talk about that. I mean, what kind of debates, what kind of disagreements? I mean, some of this stuff is politically charged or personally charged in some ways.
Well, we had a content committee made up of, I think there were nine of us, the curatorial staff, but we also consulted with a whole range of outside experts and historians from all over the state. So we were getting differences of opinions. But I think it's kind of interesting that we on the staff may not necessarily be experts in a particular area, but it also means that we may have more open minds and less of a point of view and an agenda to push.
Right.
So we're more open to hearing other sides of the story. And we would just argue these things back and forth, and we'll say, well, what about this and what about that?
Well, what are some specific examples?
I mean, we met weekly for the last 3 years, sometimes two and three times a week. And we also had a script writer. We knew that was probably one of the wisest decisions we made, to bring on a professional museum script writer. And Bob Selim, who scripted museums all over the country, was able to both question us and prod us to ask ourselves. So we asked, you know, these questions: what's the perspective we use to tell the story of the Mexican-American War? And we had, that was a very interesting exhibition for us to develop, because we had Mariana Arista's camp service, and he was a Mexican general, and we had Stephen Watts Kearney's field desk, and we had Winfield Scott's trunk and some drawings, and Randolph Marcy's material. So we had the objects of competing points of view, and that allowed us then to develop the script based on the idea that all of these people who were players in the Mexican-American War had different ideas about what they were doing, too.
And realizing that in the Mexican-American War, Mexico lost half of its territory. What does that do to the people who are left behind?
And the very emotional response. We use the village of Mesilla to talk about a village that sometimes was in the U.S. and the next day could be in Mexico. And then people moved back, you know, across the line to make sure they were in Mexico, and the line changed again, and they were back in the U.S. So, you know, we use those points of view.
And from the point of view of generals and armies, it's one thing. And from the point of view of ordinary people sitting there trying to have a life, it's irritating in a whole different way.
Well, and we tried to, we made the decision very early on to not privilege certain voices over others. So a general's voice has no more weight than the voice of the person who lived in Mesilla, or the person who lived in the villages on the Pecos River when the Texan Santa Fe expedition came in 1841.
So how refreshing.
We've tried really to tell history from the perspective of not what I call received wisdom. It's not a script of received wisdom, and then this is what happened, and that's what happened. We try to use the multiple perspective of participants.
We really sought out diaries and journals and things like that.
Letters.
You know, and not going to what someone else said about history.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's a challenge, too, because here you are starting with objects. You've got boxes, trunks, vaults, cases of objects. And then you have stories. So do you use the objects as your starting point to tell the stories, or do you use your stories as the starting points and gather in the best objects?
The answer is yes.
Yeah, both ways.
You know, one of the things that we did was the staff dispersed around the state. We did about 30 community meetings and asked historians and teachers and students and children and parents and homeschoolers, what are the stories of New Mexico history that are important? And then we looked at what are the artifacts that we have to have. And our content team would always say to each other, why are we telling that story? That's some of the creative, I would never call it conflict, but the creative tension of building was saying, are we telling that because it's an interesting fact to know and tell? Are we telling that story because it revolves around an important person whose story must be told, or it's an artifact that we have, or it's a diverse point of view that maybe hasn't been heard on a particular subject?
What are some of the points of view that you are really happy that are getting out there that maybe are voices that haven't been heard so much?
I mean,
I know it would come up. We would say, this is too many men here. We want to hear some women's voices here.
And we wanted to hear women. We wanted to hear children. Mm-hmm.
Which is not necessarily that easy, because unless a woman left a diary, and, you know, that's reasonably rare, well, how are you going to get mm-hmm. those voices?
Well, it was hard. Yeah. It was hard.
It was, and, you know, children, we often had the adult recollections of children.
Right.
Or adults' recollections about children. So, but we managed to get children into the exhibit through objects, clothing, toys, and in addition to our core exhibition, which covers New Mexico from 1500 right up to the present, we have an exhibit called Fashioning New Mexico. That's the clothing and the everyday objects and furniture mm-hmm. and toys mm-hmm. That comes out of a collection that probably people have rarely, if ever, seen from the palace. Mm-hmm. And finding the children's objects there, that's one thing that I love about that exhibit, is in addition to the inaugural gowns and the wedding gowns, we have baby dresses and high chairs and rocking horses. And so we think children will relate to, oh, look, that's how children lived in the past, before TV.
We're talking to Fran Levine and Tom Leach about the New Mexico History Museum, which is opening this Sunday. There will be a ribbon cutting at 1 in the afternoon and all sorts of things, which we'll talk about in just a little while. So New Mexico has so many voices and so much history. There's one of the less beautiful chapters is the story of the Bosque Redondo.
Right. Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, it goes back to Kit Carson, and he becomes central to the story, and he's often painted as the villain in that, but I think we portray him as a guy stuck in the middle. He received orders to either round up or kill all the Navajo he could, and he adopted this scorched earth policy, pretty infamous, but was able to... I hate to say lead, but direct the Navajo to the Bosque Redondo over at Fort Stanton.
And Fort Sumner.
Excuse me, Fort Sumner. And so we support this story with these large photographs, and I think we should talk about the photographs for one thing.
They're amazing photographs.
And
photographs you're used to seeing page size. My husband's a historian, and he said, I've seen these photographs all my career, printed page size, and some of them now are photos where you feel like you're standing on the street in Lincoln, or you're standing on a street in...
Well, they're life size.
They are
larger. It's what when you go to the movies. You know, it's why the movies have such appeal, because it's larger than life. And when you see these things, you're really taken into these photos. And because when we were on the content committee, we would look at the small photographs and make our choices, but when you walk in the gallery and see them life size, it's amazing.
One of the installers, we have an installation team that has worked together installing museums, history museums, all over the country, and a couple of them have said that the stories in this museum have moved them more than any, and one of the installers took me by the hand and took me to one of the Bosque Redondo photographs and said, if there's one photo that touches me in my heart as nothing before, it's this photo of a mother and child taken at Bosque Redondo wrapped in blankets. You saw that one yesterday.
No, that's one of the reasons I made a note of it. I mean, it's interesting what a history museum can do, because of course everybody comes away with something different. But this is, you know, rounding up people and having them in what amounts to, as you put it, a concentration camp, you know, whatever, in the previous century, well, one before that, made me think about how human cruelty just goes on everywhere in different ways, in different cultures. It just springs up, and there's no inherent good guys or bad guys, but just good actions and bad actions that we all seem to keep doing toward each other.
I mean, I think you asked, you know, what's some of the successful things about this museum, and I think it's placing the sequence and context of history so that, you know, our history in New Mexico is so deep and so we live with it on the, you know, on the surface. We have the names of places that we still carry in several different languages, you know, in New Mexico. And,
right.
And I think that the History Museum will give people context and a gateway. I think it'll allow them to say, you know, I've never seen Bosque Redondo. Let's go to the Fort Sumner Monument and see it. I've never experienced the Camino Real. Let's go to the Camino Real Monument south of Socorro, mm-hmm. and see that. I've never seen Fort Union, you know, or I've never been on the Santa Fe Trail. So we think it'll be a real gateway to the rest of the state.
Well, that and the artifacts do the same thing. It
right.
It brings you in. It makes you want to learn more about that. Or you look at something and say, hey, you know, my grandparents had something like that. And it just makes you more aware of these things. You know, we're into preservation. We are trying to save this stuff. And this is a great opportunity to present this to the public and get them thinking about what they should save. You know,
one of the things I have to mention to people was Pancho Villa's death mask with the bullet hole in his head, in his forehead. It's unbelievable.
Well, very popular before photography or
yeah, that's
you
right.
know, all the way through time. A lot of museums have great collections of death masks of faces and hands, but nobody else has the story of Pancho Villa quite the way we have it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because we juxtapose that. It's in the Mexican Revolution period is right across from New Mexico statehood. And you know, within 5 years of us becoming a state, we had this war raging, you know, this international war raging right on our border, crossing our border. It's like, wow.
Well, in the making of this, of these many exhibitions in the New Mexico History Museum, how did your own views of, you know, your own New Mexico history, both of you have been here for a very long time, how were they affected? Did you reframe some of the things you thought you knew about?
Yeah, I think the Columbus raid was one, speaking of that.
Tell us that.
Well, it was reading the Pancho Villa letters. It was reading a letter from Villa to Zapata or Zapata to Villa when they're talking about their dreams for their own country, you know, what they wanted for Mexico. And it was all of a sudden stepping away from a very American idea of we were invaded to looking at the sort of what Tom was talking about, how much territory Mexico had lost in the Mexican-American War. And thinking about the way that infused Mexico with a nationalism about their own losses.
Right.
That was very different from
Yeah, well, I think for me the real revelation is that this really was Mexico at one time. And, you know, and before that it was New Spain, but for a long time this was Mexico. So it's not like it was imposed, the U.S. was imposed on this. Well, in a way it was, but the borders just changed. But in the not too distant past, people still remembered this as Mexico.
And I think the Shifting Boundaries exhibit really brought it home for all of us, mm-hmm. was to understand the personal and the local and the national and the international implications of setting uh-huh. boundaries.
Yeah, I think what we tried to get away from was the mindset of manifest destiny.
Right.
You know, of you know, and then we were given this right to go, we were told to go west, and we went west, and we claimed this land that was a godforsaken wasteland, and look what we did with it. And,
right.
And we just really tried to avoid that.
We got away from what we would call the triumphalist history, but neither did we tell a story of defeat. We told the story of cultures mixing, merging, sometimes in conflict, sometimes in collaboration, and always toward the accommodations that make New Mexico so unique. And I think the other area I love so much is my New Mexico. And we had oral historian Jack Leffler, who went around the state for the last 3 years recording oral histories with people about what makes New Mexico their New Mexico. And it's wonderful to hear. And at the last sort of stop, if you go through the entire exhibit, is a wall full of clipboards where you can sit down and write your own story.
And will that be collected?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
you might
at
talk
some
about
point,
what we did in Kerouac.
Well, this goes back to when we had the Kerouac exhibit, and we had a couple of Underwood typewriters, the same kind that Jack Kerouac used, and we just invited people to write stories, their own version of On the Road, anecdotes, vignettes. And we put up some clipboards, and we were thinking we would get a few, and we had to take down handfuls of them every day. You know, I end up with a stack of papers about a foot high.
And we ended up putting them in notebooks and posting them on our website.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's amazing.
That's really amazing.
Were any of them good?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were some great ones. And we asked people to write haiku. And
That's
the one I loved was one written by Tom's wife, actually.
Yeah, but I can't remember what it is.
Sorry, honey. It was something like, I think I'll take to the road, and then there's the price of gas. I guess I'll just drive to Hobbs.
Yeah.
Something like that. It was great.
We're talking to Fran Levine and Tom Leach about the New Mexico History Museum. One thing that's so impressive about this museum, besides the incredible care that you put into the content, was the many different ways in which people can look at this material. There's auditoriums, there's interactive displays, there's sound, there's visuals, there's text. I mean, really, there's something for everybody, and it seems to me to take into account the fact that people have different learning styles.
Absolutely.
And different ways of dealing with information and with stuff.
That's one of the reasons we hired Patrick Gallagher and Associates out of Bethesda, Maryland, and they are very, very experienced history museum exhibition designers, and there's a wonderful article in the New Mexican supplement that just came out this week on Wednesday, and the Patrick talks about the way in which multiple learning styles is very much a part of their interpretive framework. And we interviewed about 30 exhibition design firms, and Patrick's ideas about learning in museums matched what our content curatorial team and educational team wanted to do. We really see a history museum as a lifelong learning center, a place where, you know, you come and maybe the first time you come you take in an overall impression, but then you come back because there's so much more to see and learn about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which has a website that supports the exhibition, and we worked with the National Archives for a complete scan of that document in Spanish and English. And Patrick really, we were always asking the question with Patrick Gallagher and Sujit Tolet, his designer, of what's the best way to tell the story? Is it with an interactive? Is it with a movie? Some of our interactives are just photo albums where you just flip the pages.
Right.
A quiet, meditative flip book.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say that this is really the answer to the story that I hate to say, but we've heard more than once people who said, yeah, I went to the Palace of the Governors when I was a kid, and I've been there once, and I don't need to go back. You need to come back to this many times.
Well, and that's the thing that's nice about it. I mean, especially for people who live in the Santa Fe area, and we hope there's school groups coming in from all over the state who will see it, and people who are tourists who are coming to visit Santa Fe. But for those of us living in a pretty accessible distance to the History Museum, which is right downtown, right behind the Palace of the Governors, I mean, you can no more take it in than you can take in the encyclopedia.
Exactly.
On one visit. You can just get some impressions and be drawn to something and then follow it up. But I imagine going there many times, not to mention creating it, as the two of you with all these others have done, can give a depth that is a, well, lifelong or many years long process.
You know, it's so heartening to go in there now. We've been separated from the artifacts for about 7 years because the artifacts were moved out of this terrible storage conditions to off-site storage. And so as things are being mounted, in some cases for our team, it's really the first time we've seen them. We did a lot of the designs working with photographs because the artifacts were packed away. So we go down, you know, I try to go down 3-4 times a day and walk through the exhibit and take something in, and the wow factor for us is there as well.
Yeah. Let's hear some of your favorite actual objects that have come out of hiding.
Well, I was taken yesterday. Well, okay. Don't start me. Yeah.
It's a long
okay.
List.
Well, we were installing yesterday a little dagger about 6 inches long, and it belonged to a 16-year-old boy, Mexican at the time, who worked the Santa Fe Trail. And we tell a little bit of his story. He made, was it $8 a month?
Jose Gurule.
Yeah, and yeah. And you know, but this was what this was his protection. This was the most important thing he probably owned, was that dagger. And
so then suddenly you're walking in his shoes for a minute and imagining his hand on this thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I want to show my grandkids, you know, a 16-year-old kid, you know, made his living with that.
Right.
You know? And then this morning we were installing D.H. Lawrence's satchel. And the contents of his satchel, where he has basically his Pepto-Bismol and but you know, a letter from his mother and her sewing kit that he always carried with him.
Some train tickets, I think, yeah. Right? Fun things.
It's funny. It also makes you think about how death makes a private life so public. Nobody got to look in his satchel until after.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to. Now that we're seeing these artifacts again, I keep thinking that it would be fun to do a book of biographies of the artifacts. You know, how right. They came, how the person acquired them, how they came to be important and have meaning. Mm-hmm. What was the journey that they went through a person's life, and then how did they come to rest in the museum yeah. collections?
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, there's research to be done about these.
Everyone.
That little articulated wooden toy from San Ildefonso that
right.
came to us from Gustav Bauman's daughter. It was given to Bauman in the 20s, and I've got a photograph of it above his studio door. But we really don't know much about the piece other than it's probably 18th century, and it's a little toy conquistador. So tell me about that. How did
graduate
that happen?
Students take notes.
Yes.
We have doctoral dissertations for the next 50 years out of the collections. And, you know, we have this fabulous photo archives and the three-dimensional collections of furniture, the costumes. The costumes in Fashioning New Mexico are quite the fashion show.
Everybody will get to see them. I was just looking through the window yesterday at these things. The building was closed. But it's wonderful to see exhibitions like that on display that nobody's ever gotten to see before. Lest you think that it's all 19th century back to prehistory, there's also the Dust Bowl, the WPA, World War II, Los Alamos. There's things about land grants, about hippies, and really taking you all the way up to the present.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk for a moment about the excavation. You had to dig a big hole, and you found a million things in the hole.
Just shy of a million artifacts.
Literally a million.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, if you pick up an ear of corn and 300 kernels fall off, that's 300 artifacts.
Oh,
but
really?
Still, you know,
okay.
I mean, somebody has to count them and catalog them. But nevertheless, that's still a lot of things to come out of that former parking lot.
Well, that was an excavation carried out by the Office of Archaeological Studies with a huge cast of volunteers. I bet many of your listeners volunteered on
right.
that excavation. Mm-hmm. Went on for about 2 years. It started in October 2002, and I think we went right through to February or March of 2004.
It was October 10th.
How do you remember that?
Because I had a visiting artist that day. That was when Jim Sheridan from Hatch came.
And it was threatening to rain.
Well, and they did the sonar testing. They wouldn't let us park in the parking lot, and they did a sonar testing in the parking lot, and that was the first day they worked out there.
That's amazing that you remember. And anyways, a fabulous excavation, and you know, we had been told by a couple of people who don't know archaeology that there wouldn't be anything there, that it was a parking lot.
Right.
But, of course, that's where we found the Presidio walls from the 1790 Presidio. We found the foundations of the 19th century assayer's office, mineral assayer's office. We found a 19th century military well where they had buried an entire horse at the end of the occupation of this area. We found.
So you have a horse skeleton among your artifacts?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
well,
it was fully articulated.
I have to get a plug in for the Palace Press. We just did archaeology in the rooms of the Palace Press that were being renovated, and we finally found the long-lost latrine that was said to be there, which is why the floor collapsed in the first place.
That's hilarious.
And we're happy to report that, yes, it was a latrine.
Yes.
So what's going to happen now? You've got some renovation going on at the Palace Press as well.
Right. Well, we just finished putting down the hardwood floor, and it will be sanded and sealed, and then the presses come back in, and I hope by mid-June we will be up and running again and functioning as a working exhibit, which will include...
A working exhibit means what? You're going to be actually printing
things?
Well,
we print things, and people come in and watch and talk to us and ask us what we're doing. It's really a lot of fun. But we will also, for the first time, have a more or less permanent exhibit. We'll have a recreation of Gustav Bauman's studio. And then the Estancia,
which whom everybody knows now because of the exhibition,
the Marionette.
Well, the Marionette show, sure,
yeah.
Sure. And his home has recently been purchased by the Historic Santa Fe Foundation and will undergo a renovation. So it's an important historic house.
The New Mexico History Museum opens this coming weekend. So there's going to be a big event. Well, let's see, music from 9 to noon, and then Native American drumming from noon to 1 in the Palace Courtyard, free admission all day, a big ribbon cutting from 1 to 3, a lowriders procession happening.
On the plaza.
So a lot of this happening on the plaza. I would think that on the one hand, it would be a great day to go down there and experience it. And on the other hand, if you want to go and really see it in a little bit more of a quiet time, you would go after the museum is open.
Yeah, for New Mexicans, the museum is always free on Sundays, and it's also free for New Mexicans, senior citizens of New Mexico. On Wednesdays, we're open and free on Friday nights from 5 to 8. So there's many, many opportunities to visit the museum, and we hope that teachers who are listening will bring their school groups and that doesn't just mean small children. We hope university professors will also bring students.
And ride the Rail Runner up.
What a great idea.
Well, the Rail Runner is running specially this weekend on their Saturday schedule. They're running Saturday, Sunday, and Monday to bring people from Albuquerque to Santa Fe for the opening of the New Mexico History Museum.
And Monday is New Mexico History Museum Family Day, so that's free admission on Monday from 10 to 5. And all sorts of other things going on. There's an interfaith service at St. Francis Cathedral at 10 in the morning. Much, much, much to do. And
and an ice cream social.
Now you're talking.
On Monday afternoon at 1 in the courtyard, sponsored by Los Compadres del Palacio, our support group and our advocates, our friends, our sponsors, and helping hands in every way.
Everybody's coming out for this.
We have so many people helping with every event, and Los Compadres are dishing up ice cream as fast as they can.
Fran Levine is the director of the New Mexico History Museum. Tom Leach is curator of the Palace Press. We will see you this weekend. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz.